narrative about Guantanamo.
Mansour, we have to leave it there, but I want to encourage people to watch The Hour with Mansour Adaifi, who was imprisoned without charge for 14 years. And thank you so much to James Yee. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wear a mask. Stay safe.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m., streaming online. Racial and social justice activist Ajama Umi will deliver a keynote presentation addressed, Does American Identity Equal White Supremacy? This MLK observance will also feature a Q&A session, songs, and readings. Again, that's the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the COVID-19 Omicron variant continues to spread as test positivity rates near an all-time high in Oregon. The City of Portland and federal officials have reached a tentative agreement on police accountability and body cameras. And the Red Cross has announced a national blood crisis for the first time in its history. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 11th, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Oregon Health Authority reported Monday that more than 18,000 new confirmed or presumptive COVID-19 cases were identified over the weekend. The state has a positive test rate of just over 22% as the highly contagious Omicron variant continues to spread rapidly. The number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 in Oregon increased to 692. Hospitalizations are still about 40% below their peak during the summer surge of the Delta variant. However, hospitals in the state have just 7% of their non-ICU adult beds available. Oregon health officials also reported 18 new deaths on Monday, raising the state's death toll to 5,779 people. Portland area schools are also feeling the pressure of the Omicron wave. Many students will not be learning in person for the next week, and for some school districts, even longer. Colt Gill, director of Oregon's Department of Education, said, quote, "The primary reason is that there is too many staff impacted by COVID-19 to be able to operate schools in person. They're either ill or quarantined. This will cause challenges for everyone in that school community," end quote. All extracurricular activities, such as sports, practices, and performances, are being postponed for the time being. Nationally, the U.S. reported 1.34 million cases of COVID-19 on Monday, breaking its previous record for daily cases. It also represents the highest daily total recorded for any country in the world, with the U.S. recording about 61.5 million cases since the COVID-19 pandemic began. The seven-day average for cases in the U.S. also reached its highest point yet on Monday, with 24 states reporting their highest seven-day average of all time. The record high numbers come as COVID hospitalizations in the U.S. have also soared, with the 7-day average for hospitalizations up 83% in the last 2 weeks. CDC projections suggest that the Omicron variant may now account for approximately 95% of COVID cases in the country. COVID-19 cases are surging in Oregon. That's driving state health officials to urge people to not only get vaccinated, but to get their booster shots as well. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Oregon is in the midst of its biggest spike in COVID-19 cases since the start of the pandemic. Health officials are urging the public to get vaccinated, or if they're already vaccinated, to get a booster shot. The Omicron variant is driving cases up across the country. Dr. Leona O'Keefe is public health officer with Jackson County Public Health. She says people who are vaccinated need to consider a booster, noting that folks with the first series of vaccine are 30 to 40% protected against infection from Omicron.
If you've been boosted, you're about 70 to 75% protected. So obviously there's quite a big difference in your level of protection once you're boosted.
O'Keefe says even people with boosters might still feel ill, but their chances of spreading COVID-19, being hospitalized, or dying are cut down massively. Guidelines for when to get a booster recently changed, with folks who received Moderna or Pfizer vaccines eligible for a booster after 5 months. Boosters are suggested after 2 months for people who received the Johnson & Johnson shot. Salim Nurani owns 3 liquor stores in the Willamette Valley and is an AARP Oregon Executive Council member. He says one of his employees was exposed during the December rush. That meant he lost a quarter of his full-time workforce, underscoring the importance of protecting people with the vaccine.
So for small business owners, we're trying to give everybody enough hours so you're not overstaffed. But when you're hit with something like this, you know, it has a huge impact.
Older people are the most likely to be vaccinated and boosted. O'Keefe says it's also important for young people to get vaccinated to ensure the virus doesn't have the opportunity to spread to vulnerable people.
Please protect yourself and take care of those around you. And to those of you who are already taking these steps, I would say thank you. We appreciate it. It's helping your community.
Governor Kate Brown is spearheading a campaign to get boosters to 1 million Oregonians by the end of January. To date, the state has reached about a quarter of that goal. Some health risks have stopped people from getting the vaccine, including reports of myocarditis in young men, which has occurred in a small number of cases. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
The World Health Organization said on Tuesday that the Omicron variant of COVID-19 is on track to infect more than half of Europe. The continent had more than 7 million new coronavirus cases in just the first week of 2022. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
The World Health Organization projects half of Europe will have been infected with the Omicron COVID-19 variant within 6 to 8 weeks. 7 million new cases were reported in Europe in the first week of 2022, doubling over a two-week period. At least 50 of 53 countries in Europe and Central Asia have reported cases involving Omicron. The record number of infected people is already straining European healthcare systems. On January 10th, the UK reported 142,224 new cases of coronavirus. Poland, with a 40% rate of unvaccinated residents, reported 100,000 people have died since the start of the pandemic. Because Omicron infections might be milder than with other coronavirus variants, some European leaders have suggested it can be tracked and treated like a flu-like endemic illness rather than a pandemic. This would entail not recording every case and not testing all patients presenting with symptoms. Senior Emergency Officer for Europe, Catherine Smallwood, says that approach is a ways off because a true endemic illness must have stable and predictable transmission. She said, quote, "We still have a huge amount of uncertainty and a virus that is evolving quite quickly, imposing new challenges. It may become endemic in due course, but pinning that down to 2022 is a little bit difficult at this stage," end quote. The organization is concerned that we may still see significant morbidity, especially in vulnerable populations. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The City of Portland and the Oregon Department of Justice have reached a tentative agreement on several changes to bring the city back into compliance with a 2014 settlement designed to lessen police use of excessive force. The agreement will go before the Portland City Council for a vote later this month. This comes 2 months after a federal judge directed all parties to return to mediation to work out lingering differences. there are two main clauses added as a result of the latest talks. First, the city agreed that not just high-ranking command officers would be investigated and held accountable for improper use of force during protests in 2020, but so would rank-and-file officers. Second, the Justice Department will reserve final approval on any body camera policy that the city negotiates with the police union. The Justice Department has advised the city that officers should write their initial use of force reports before viewing body camera video. Officers could later view the footage and write a supplemental report. The federal lawyers have also advised the city that it should control access to the body camera videos and that supervisors should have access to the recordings. The agreement also states that the city of Portland will fund an outside consultant to review police use of force during protests in 2020 and hire a civilian dean of police training. In addition, the city will have its independent police review office investigate any lieutenants or supervisors of higher rank from the rapid response team who directed or allowed officers to violate the Bureau's force policy. Portland City employees in six labor unions are voting this week on whether or not to authorize a strike. This comes after contract negotiations between the unions and the City of Portland have reached an impasse in recent days. The six unions involved in the voting are AFSCME Local 189, IBEW Local 48, Operating Engineers Local 701, Machinist District Lodge 24, Plumbers Local 290, and Painters and Allied Trades District Council 5. The unions say elected officials need to take responsibility for budgeting better for their workforce. The biggest impacts from a strike would be to bureaus that handle Portland's water, transportation, development services, policing, and finances. It would also have ripple effects on all aspects of city life, as more than 1,100 workers are expected to strike. Union leaders say they are asking for longevity premiums, higher wages to keep up with inflation, and proper compensation for people with advanced skills. The voting on whether to authorize the strike will continue all week. Because of the pandemic, some voting is in person and some is online. Officials will tally the votes over the weekend and expect to have results by Sunday or Monday. The bargaining teams for both the city and the unions were scheduled to meet for another negotiating session on Tuesday. Recent water samples have alarmed the Portland Water Bureau as levels of lead found in Portland water has been above what is considered safe. In November of 2021, 10% of water samples from 104 Portland homes with lead components showed that lead levels were as high as 21 parts per billion, an amount that well exceeds the federal limit. This isn't the first time Portland has exceeded these limits. The federal safety threshold for lead has been surpassed 11 different times in the city since the late 1990s. The level of contamination in the most recent report is the highest it's been since the 2000s. The Oregon Health Authority's Division for Drinking Water is asking the Portland Water Bureau for a plan with short-term measures, including further adjustments to treatment, enhanced public education, and outreach. Virginia Tech professor Dr. Mark Edwards compared the lead contamination in Portland to the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. The Portland Water Bureau argues that there are some key differences between the two cities' water issues. The source for the water contamination in Flint was service lines that affected the entire community. The Portland Water Bureau has said the main source for Portland's water contamination is lead solder in copper pipes in individual homes. This includes up to 15,000 homes that were built between 1970 and 1985. Edwards notes that Portland is the largest major city in the country that has consistently had high amounts of lead in its water. Chicago public schools could resume in-person classes this week after the Chicago Teachers Union agreed to a new set of COVID-19 mitigation measures. The tentative agreement comes after 4 days of canceled classes, with educators asking for more testing, more support with personal protective equipment, and a procedure for controlling outbreaks in schools. Lily Bulkey has more on the story.
The Chicago Teachers Union held a day of action yesterday, outdoors and in their cars, in an effort to safely push back against returning immediately to in-person classes with the surge of the Omicron variant hitting the area hard. Teachers in the union have proposed a return to online learning until January 18th to avoid a major outbreak. Mayor Lori Lightfoot has so far opposed returning even short-term to online learning, saying it's safer for kids to be in-person in school for social, emotional, and developmental reasons. CTU President Jesse Sharkey says the educators want that too.
We've been in schools during a pandemic trying to educate children, and that's where we want to be again. But we're asking for some basic common sense safety measures.
The union is asking for more support from the city for testing and personal protective equipment, and they say there should be procedures in place for outbreaks in schools. Monday marked the fourth day of canceled school. Chicago currently has an opt-in testing program for public school students, but the union says not enough people opt in, and it would be better to have an opt-out program. Sharkey says when it comes to controlling outbreaks in schools, if too many educators, staff, or students are out due to COVID, he says it's worth temporarily returning to remote learning.
If you say school's open, it's all good, and half the students don't show up, you're not doing any learning for half the students.
He says if 25% of staff, 30% of elementary school students, or 25% of high school students are absent due to COVID, that should be a signal for individual schools to go online to allow cases to slow. I'm Lee Bulkey reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for It Did Happen Here, a historical short-form documentary podcast that chronicles how immigrants, civil rights activists, and militant youth worked together in Portland against racist white skinheads in the 1980s and 90s. Then at 6, it's Preference, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 58 degrees. Today in history, in 1908, U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt declares the Grand Canyon in northwest Arizona a national monument. Today, more than 5 million people visit the canyon each year. The quote of the day is from American politician, conservationist, and writer Theodore Roosevelt, who served as the 26th president of the United States. Roosevelt said, quote, "Let this great wonder of nature remain as it is now. You cannot improve on it, but what you can do is keep it for your children, your children's children, and all who come after you, as the one great sight which every American should see." The Red Cross has declared its first ever national blood crisis. The humanitarian group said the nation's blood supply is dangerously low, as the COVID-19 pandemic has caused a decline in donor turnout, the cancellation of blood drives, and staffing challenges. In 2021, the Red Cross saw a 34% decline in new donors. A joint statement from the Red Cross, America's Blood Centers, and the Association for the Advancement of Blood and Biotherapies warned, quote, "If the nation's blood supply does not stabilize soon, life-saving blood may not be available for some patients when it is needed," end quote. Many blood centers across the U.S. have reported less than a one-day supply of some blood types. During a press conference Tuesday morning, spokespeople from Oregon Health and Science University urged those who are eligible to donate, as the low blood supply poses a danger to patients. During the pandemic, the number of people giving blood dropped 10% nationally, and school and college blood drives dropped 62%. Hospitals need blood for surgeries, transplants, cancer treatments, and chronic illnesses. But the Red Cross says that during this historic shortage, there are days it can't give hospitals all of the blood products they request. As much as a quarter of hospital needs nationwide are not being met. Those able to donate are urged to make their appointments in advance at redcrossblood.org/give. The State Department continues talks with Russia over troops surrounding Ukraine. Representative Jim Jordan will not comply with the January 6th panel, and the Senate plans to take up voting rights. With those stories and more, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
This buildup
of nearly 100,000 Russian troops. In recent weeks, we've called it unusual. We've called it massive. We have called it concerning. It is all of those things.
The U.S. is entering day two of a week-long series of diplomatic talks with Russia in the latest attempt to find a middle ground between NATO and Russia over increasing tensions along the Ukrainian border, where State Department spokesperson Ned Price says nearly 100,000 Russian troops have amassed in recent months. The New York Times reports the troops have surrounded Ukraine on three sides and what NATO leaders fear is a possible prelude to military action. But Defense Department spokesperson John Kirby says the Pentagon is letting the State Department take point on the discussions.
We're very much in support of diplomacy taking the lead here to try to find a way to de-escalate the tensions and to get to a better outcome. We're fully in support of that.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the chamber will hold a vote to attempt to pass new voting rights legislation later this week. The bill will almost certainly fail as Democrats haven't been able to secure a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority.
Everyone in this chamber will have a chance to go on record. Will Republicans join Democrats in a bipartisan manner to move forward on defending democracy? Or will they once again mount a filibuster and offer their implicit endorsement of the big lie?
Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona remain opposed to eliminating the filibuster, which would allow measures to pass with a simple majority. Meanwhile, a Wisconsin judge is permitting a partisan investigation into the November 2020 election to continue, for now. The review is led by former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman at the behest of Republican leadership in the state's legislature. Wisconsin's Democratic Attorney General sued to block subpoenas Gableman issued to state election officials, but a circuit court judge ruled Monday the investigator's subpoenas were valid. The review has been criticized by voting rights groups, Democrats, and some Republicans, including Senator Kathleen Bernier, chair of the Wisconsin Senate's Committee on Elections, who has accused Gableman of undermining the democratic process.
When Benjamin Franklin came out of the convention and our Constitution was created, he was asked, "What kind of a government do we have?" And he said, "A republic if we can keep it. We're in jeopardy of losing it."
Politico reports Republican Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio is resisting an interview request from the panel tasked with investigating the January 6th insurrection. Jordan, a staunch Trump ally, wrote in a four-page letter to the panel's leader the request was a, quote, "unprecedented and inappropriate demand," unquote. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. Supreme Court lets a decision stand, saying that the McGirt ruling is not retroactive. Albuquerque seeks input on the next steps for a school burial site, and COVID-19 is the leading cause of death for Montana Native Americans. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court let a lower court decision stand that McGirt versus Oklahoma is not retroactive, the Oklahoman reports. In 2020, the High Court affirmed the Muskogee Nation's reservation in the McGirt ruling, that the reservation was never disestablished. Criminal jurisdiction of major crimes involving Native Americans on reservations are handled by federal or tribal court. The state of Oklahoma has been trying to limit McGirt. Tribes say it's about sovereignty and have been working to implement positive changes in their justice systems. The city of Albuquerque, New Mexico, has scheduled community conversations this week involving the burial site at a city park, which is associated with the former Albuquerque Indian School. The public is invited to attend the meetings to provide input and learn about plans for the area at 4-H Park. The city is seeking historical information on the local, state, and federal level. The city plans to investigate using ground-penetrating radar. The results will be shared first with tribes and pueblos and then with the general public. In September 2021, Albuquerque Mayor Tim Keller apologized publicly for the city's role in Indian boarding schools. The city says it's a step toward reconciliation and is working with the Native community on recommendations to honor students at the burial site. In October, on Indigenous Peoples Day, Keller signed a resolution to formally recognize the burial site. Here's part of Keller's remarks during the event in downtown Albuquerque.
We made sure and made it clear that as a city, at least, we formally apologized for not only the way that was handled in the past, in terms of when we built the park, but also for the concept of these boarding schools that absolutely were wrong in every way, whether it was tearing apart families or erasing culture. And so I want to just reiterate that apology on the city's behalf today.
The city acquired the park in the 1970s and took over maintenance of land known to be the burial site of the school. The Presbyterian Church ran the school in the 1880s. It was later transferred to federal control and operated until 1981. The city has marked off a portion of the park and removed it from park uses. The site is open to pueblos and tribes for ceremonies and practices. The community meetings this week will be held virtually. COVID-19 was the leading cause of death among American Indians in Montana in 2020, according to a state health department report. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton explains.
According to a review of death certificates by the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services, deaths among American Indian and Alaska Natives spiked 36% in 2020 compared to the previous 5 years, largely due to COVID-19. The analysis shows the rate of COVID deaths among American Indian and Alaska Native people in Montana was over double that of Indigenous people across the entire country. People identifying as Indigenous in Montana account for about 7% of the state's total population and accounted for 15% of the coronavirus mortalities in 2020, according to a state health department report. The state health department says there are several reasons for these disparities, including more multi-generational households among Native American families, lack of access to health care, and a higher rate of underlying health conditions like diabetes and chronic lung diseases. COVID-19 was the third leading cause of death statewide in 2020. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Demand for electric vehicles is causing a battery supply chain bottleneck. Lithium, cobalt, and nickel are all used in the production of most EV batteries. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many countries and automakers have ambitious plans to transition to electric cars, trucks, and buses within 10 to 20 years.
Demand for batteries is growing at an incredible rate.
Andrew Miller is Chief Operating Officer at Benchmark Mineral Intelligence. The company analyzes the supply chain for the lithium-ion batteries used in most electric vehicles. Battery production starts with mining lithium, cobalt, and nickel, which can be costly and environmentally destructive. And Miller says the markets for these raw materials remain relatively small, so they'll need tremendous scaling up to keep pace with demand.
So that requires a huge amount of investment. It requires the development of new technologies to extract these raw materials.
And it takes time. He says developing new mining operations can take 5 to 10 years.
And that's going to cause some real bottleneck issues and turbulence in these markets over the next few years.
After mining, materials need processing before they can be used in batteries. Miller says currently, most of the raw material processing facilities are in China. That puts other countries at risk of supply chain disruptions. So to meet targets for rolling out EVs, he says countries around the world must invest in all stages of the EV battery supply chain. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 11th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Caitlin Backus and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Jonah Chester, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. coming up tomorrow morning on KABU. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, covering art, culture, and politics, with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Dirtbag. Host Glenn Anderson is joined by guest Jim Gilbert to talk about where to get your seeds, growing olives in the Pacific Northwest, and tips on how to prune a dormant fruit tree. All of these KABU programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kabu.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for It Did Happen Here.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KABU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
I had joined the Coalition for Human Dignity. It was something that I was interested in as a Jew and wanted to help with. So 2 weeks after I had joined, nothing was purposeful on this at all. But what happened was my daughter and two of her friends were coming home along Southeast 39th. They were between Hawthorne and Alder. And a truckload of skinheads went by, about seven of them, some in the back and some in the front. And they were doing Sieg Heils, shouting Nazi slogans.
Carloads of Nazi boneheads would drive around and look for people to attack. They were driving along Hawthorne Boulevard. A young woman and two men were walking along Hawthorne. One of the Nazi boneheads gave a Nazi salute. One of the teenagers flipped them off with both fingers, you know. They grabbed their baseball bats and chased them for blocks.
So they took off running, and the skinheads followed them and started chasing them with baseball bats, 2x4s. Luckily, my daughter knocked on someone's door. She screamed,